Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
All right, so today we are going to be going over Parashat Emor. So God has a lot of stuff to say today, and that is what we're going to be covering. We're covering Leviticus 21 through 24. And one of the things you should take a look for in here is, in the midst of all these instructions, we're going to see a lot of instructions of stuff that the priests do. But one of the things to take a look at is what we talk a lot about holiness and holiness being set apart and something set apart for a certain purpose, set apart from something else. But one of the things we should take a look at in this is what makes the realm of God different from the whole rest of the world. Talked a bit about the tragedies that happen from day to day of crashes and disasters and death and such. And you'll see mention of death and things related to dealing with death in here today. And you'll notice that there's a lot of care that's taken about what happens with the people who minister inside the tabernacle, the dwelling place of God, and death. So one of the things that we'll be looking at today is, what is all this separateness about? And what is God trying to communicate with this? So we're starting in Leviticus 21 and going through chapter 24. Then the Lord said to Moshe, "Speak to the priests, the sons of Aharon, and say to them, 'No one shall defile himself with a dead person among his people, except for his relatives who are nearest to him, his mother and his father, and his son and his daughter and his brother, and also for his virgin sister who is near to him because she has no husband. For her he may defile himself. He shall not defile himself as a relative by marriage among his people, and so profane himself. They shall not make any baldness on their heads, nor shave off the edges of their beards, nor make any cuts in their flesh. They shall be holy to their God and not profane the name of their God, for they present the offerings by fire to the Lord, the food of their God. So they shall be holy. They shall not take a woman who is profane by harlotry, nor shall they take a woman divorced from her husband, for he is holy to his God. You shall consecrate him, therefore, for he offers the food of your God. He shall be holy to you, for I, the Lord, who sanctifies you, am holy. Also, the daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by harlotry, she profanes her father. She shall be burned with fire. The priest who is highest among his brothers, on whose head the anointing oil has been poured, and who has been consecrated to wear the garments, shall not uncover his head nor tear his clothes. Nor shall he approach any dead person, nor defile himself even for his father or his mother. Nor shall he go out of the sanctuary, nor profane the sanctuary of his God. For the consecration of the anointing oil of his God is on him. I am the Lord. He shall take a wife in her virginity, a widow or a divorced woman, or one who is profaned by harlotry, these he may not take, but rather he is to marry a virgin of his own people, so that he will not profane his offspring among his people, for I am the Lord who sanctifies him. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, Speak to Aharon, saying, No man of your offspring throughout your generations who has a defect shall approach to offer the food of his God. For no one who has a defect shall approach, a blind man or a lame man or he who has a disfigured face or any deformed limb, or a man who has a broken foot or a broken hand, or a hunchback or a dwarf, or one who has a defect in his eye, or a sema, or scabs, or crushed testicles. No man among the descendants of Aaron the priest who has a defect is to come near to offer the Lord's offerings by fire. Since he has a defect, he shall not come near to offer the food of his God. He may eat the food of his God, both of the most holy and of the holy, only he shall not go into the veil or come near the altar, because he has a defect, so that he will not profane my sanctuaries. For I am the Lord who sanctifies him. So Moshe spoke to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel. Chapter 22. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, Tell Aaron and his sons to be careful with the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they dedicate to me, so as not to profane my holy name. I am the Lord. Say to them, If any man among all your descendants throughout your generations approaches the holy gifts which the sons of Israel dedicate to the Lord, while he is in uncleanness, that person shall be cut off from before me. I am the Lord. No man of the descendants of Aaron who is a leper or who has a discharge may eat the holy gifts until he is clean. If one touches anything made unclean by a corpse, or if a man has a seminal mission, or if a man touches any teeming thing by which he is made unclean, or any man by whom he is made unclean, whatever is unclean. A person who touches any such shall be unclean until evening, and shall not eat of the holy gifts unless he has bathed his body in water. But when the sun sets, he will be clean, and afterward shall eat of the holy gifts, for it is his food. He shall not eat an animal which dies or is torn by beasts, becoming unclean by it. I am the Lord. They shall therefore keep my charge, so that they will not bear sin because of it, and die therefore because they profane it. I am the Lord who sanctifies them. No layman, however, is to eat the holy gift. A sojourner with the priest or a hired hand shall not eat of the holy gift. But if a priest buys a slave as his property with his money, that one may eat it, and those who are born in his house may eat of his food. If a priest's daughter is married to a layman, she shall not eat any of the offerings of the gifts. But if a priest's daughter becomes a widow or divorced and has no child and returns to her father's house as in her youth, she shall eat of her father's food, but no layman shall eat it. But if a man eats a holy gift unintentionally, then he shall add to it a fifth of it, and shall give the holy gift to the priest. They shall not profane the holy gifts of the sons of Israel, which they offer to the Lord, and so cause them to bear punishment for guilt by eating their holy gifts. For I am the Lord who sanctifies them. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel, and say to them, Any man of the house of Israel or of the aliens in Israel who presents his offering, whether it is any of their votive or any of their free will offerings, which they present to the Lord for a burnt offering, for you to be accepted, it must be a male without defect from the cattle, the sheep, or the goats. Whatever is a defect, you shall not offer it, for it will not be accepted for you. When a man offers a sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord to fulfill a special vow or free will offering of the herd or the flock, it must be perfect to be accepted. There shall be no defect in it. Those that are blind or fractured or maimed or having a running sore or zema or scabs, you shall not offer to the Lord, nor make of them an offering by fire on the altar of the Lord. In respect to an ox or a lamb which is overgrown or stunted member, you may present it for a freewill offering, but for a vow it will not be accepted. Also, anything with its testicles bruised or crushed or torn or cut, You shall not offer to the Lord or sacrifice in your land, nor shall you accept any such from the hand of a foreigner for offering as the food of your God, for their corruption is in them. They have a defect. They shall not be accepted for you. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, when an ox or a sheep or a goat is born, it shall remain 7 days with its mother. From the eighth day on, it shall be accepted as a sacrifice of an offering by fire to the Lord. Whether it's an ox or a sheep, you shall not kill both it and its young in one day. When you sacrifice a sacrifice of thanksgiving to the Lord, you shall sacrifice it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten on the same day. You shall leave none of it until morning. I am the Lord. You shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. You shall not profane my holy name, but I will be sanctified among the sons of Israel. I am the Lord who sanctifies you, who brought you out from the land of Mitzrayim to be your God. I am the Lord. Chapter 23. The Lord spoke again to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, the Lord's appointed times, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, my appointed times are these. For 6 days you may work, but on the seventh day there is a Shabbat of complete rest, holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It is a Shabbat to the Lord in all your dwellings. These are the appointed times of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at the times appointed for them. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at twilight, is the Lord's Pesach. Then, on the 15th day of the same month, there is a feast of matzot to the Lord. For 7 days you shall eat matzot. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. But for 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the seventh day there is a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land which I am going to give you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring in the sheaf of your first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord for you to be accepted. And on the day after the Shabbat, the priest shall wave it. Now, on the day when you wave the sheaf, you shall offer a male lamb 1 year old without defect for a burnt offering to the Lord. It is grain. Its grain offering shall then be 2/10 of an ephah, fine flour mixed with oil, an offering by fire to the Lord for a soothing aroma. It is drink with its drink offering, 1/4 of a hin of wine. Till the same day, until you have brought in the offering of your God, you shall eat neither bread, nor roasted grain, nor new growth. It is to be a perpetual statute throughout your generations, in all your dwelling places. Then you shall also count for yourselves from the day after the Shabbat, from the day when you brought in the sheaf of the wave offering, there shall be 7 complete Shabbats. You shall count 50 days to the day after the seventh Shabbat. Then you shall present a new grain offering to the Lord. You shall bring in from your dwelling places 2 loaves of bread for a wave offering made of 2/10 of an ephah. They shall be of a fine flour baked with leaven as first fruits to the Lord. Along with the bread, you shall present 7 1-year-old male lambs without defect, a bull from the herd, and 2 rams. They are to be a burnt offering to the Lord, with their grain offering and their drink offerings, for an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. You shall also offer 1 male goat for a sin offering, and 2 male lambs 1 year old for a sacrifice of peace offerings. The priest shall then wave them with the bread of the first fruits for a wave offering with 2 lambs before the Lord. They are to be holy to the Lord for the priest. On the same day, you shall make a proclamation as well. You are to have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. It is to be a perpetual statute in all your dwelling places throughout your generations. When you reap the harvest of your land, moreover, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor gather the gleaning of your harvest. You are to leave them for the needy and the alien. I am the Lord, your God. Again, the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, in the seventh month of the first, on the first of the month, you shall have a rest, a reminder by blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work, but you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. The Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, on exactly the tenth day of this month is the Day of Atonement. On it shall be a holy convocation for you, and you shall humble your souls and present an offering by fire to the Lord. You shall not do any work on the same day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement on your behalf before the Lord your God. If there is any person who will not humble himself on the same day, he shall be cut off from his people. As for any person who does any work on the same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no work at all. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. It is to be a Shabbat of complete rest for you. And you shall humble your souls. On the ninth of the month at evening, from evening until evening, you shall keep your Shabbat. Again, the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, on the 15th of the seventh month is the feast of Sukkot, for 7 days to the Lord. On the first day is a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work of any kind. For 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day you shall have a holy convocation and present an offering by fire to the Lord. It is an assembly. You shall do no laborious work. These are the appointed times of the Lord, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, to present offerings by fire to the Lord, burnt offerings and grain offerings, sacrifices and drink offerings, each day's matter on its own day. Besides those of the Shabbats of the Lord, and besides your gifts, and besides all your votive and free will offerings, which you give to the Lord. On exactly the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered in the crops of your land, you shall celebrate the feast of the Lord for 7 days, with a rest on the first day and a rest on the eighth day. Now on the first day you shall take for yourselves the foliage of beautiful trees, palm branches, and boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord for 7 days. You shall thus celebrate it as a feast of the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. You shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths when I brought them out from the land of Mitzrayim. I am the Lord your God. So Moshe declared to the sons of Israel the appointed times of the Lord. Chapter 24. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, command the sons of Israel that they bring to you clear oil from beaten olives for the light, the menorah, to make the lamp burn continually. Outside the veil of testimony in the tent of meeting, Aharon shall keep it in order from evening to morning before the Lord continually. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. You shall keep the lamps in order on the pure gold lampstand before the Lord continually. Then you shall take fine flour and bake 12 cakes with it. 2 tenths of an ephah shall be in each cake. You shall set them in 2 rows, 6 to a row, on the pure gold table before the Lord. You shall put frankincense on each row so that it may be a memorial portion for the bread, even an offering by fire to the Lord. Every Shabbat he shall set it in order before the Lord continually. It is an everlasting covenant for the sons of Israel. It shall be for Aharon and his sons, and they shall eat it a holy place, for it is most holy to him from the Lord's offerings by fire, his portion forever. Now the son of a Israel woman, whose father was an Egyptian, went out among the sons of Israel, and the Israelites' woman's son and a man of Israel struggled with each other in the camp. The son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name and cursed, so they brought him to Moshe. Now his mother's name was Shulamit, the daughter of Dibri of the tribe of Dan. They put him in custody so that the command of the Lord may be made clear to them. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Bring the one who is cursed outside the camp, and let all who heard him lay their hands on his head. Then let all the congregation stone him. You shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, 'If anyone curses his God, then he will bear his sin.' Moreover, the one who blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall surely stone him, the alien as well as the native. When he blasphemes the name, he shall be put to death. If a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. The one who takes the life of an animal shall make it good, life for life. If a man injures his neighbor, just as he has done, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, just as he injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. Thus the one who kills an animal shall make it good, but the one who kills a man shall be put to death. There shall be one standard for you. It shall be for the stranger as well as the native, for I am the Lord your God." Then Moshe spoke to the sons of Israel, and they brought the one who had cursed outside the camp and stoned him with stones. Thus the sons of Israel did, just as the Lord had commanded Moshe. Okay, well, before we get started with further discussion, are there any observations or questions or things that you observed?
An awful lot of rules and regulations.
Yes, that's what we were talking about at the outset.
Yeah, and impossible to keep without Jesus, of course.
Mm.
So how does this apply to, Christ went out and when he walked among us, among everybody, he touched the dead bodies. He did all these things. How do we look at that today? And, you know, from a Jewish perspective, you know, that he did all these things which would nullify him as being the high priest, right?
Well, that would be a very interesting point.
Well, I mean, because like a Jewish perspective, like my mom, Christ did all the things that, in here in the beginning, in the Torah, were not allowed. So everything that he did, touching the dead body, doing all the things that he did, you know, if we look from their perspective, how can you reason with someone like that? You know, like.
Well, that's actually a big topic of the book of Hebrews. That's one of the things we'll go over. Any other comments?
I was thinking of that same point there, except the only thing is the Jews will look at the deed, but they won't look at the heart. And so, you know, what did he say? He said, God looks at your heart, and the law has to be explained through, you know, the heart and what the need is at the moment. So now I was thinking of David and the bread on the showbread, you know, and was there any kind of consequence for David and the showbread?
Yeah.
You know,
there
wasn't any consequence. It was just that the Lord said, it was Shabbat too when he ate the showbread. So, I mean, he did two things, you know, but the Lord said, it's a heart matter. It's not a matter of, you know, your laws and regulations without your heart being before God. In a humble state, you know, knowing your condition.
Being Jewish and knowing that's what's hard to like explain, because you know, to my mom to try to explain to somebody, because that's what you're doing, is you're going to the lost house of Israel and you're going to try to explain to them that Yeshua is your Messiah. You know, of course, we, you know, my perspective has always been that because the feast days and everything, that's a dead giveaway. But the part about it is that how do you explain to them, to someone, that, you know, that is your Messiah? You know, because of it just seems like it's so hard. And I just wanted to propose it in a right question, you know, and then a lamb of 1 year old, you know, I know that there's something deeper here that's going on, you know, and just finding the right question in a way to propose it.
Okay.
Just another point is, I think the thing that came to my mind is, you know, the priest went by, the Samaritan was on the ground. He was practically dead. And the Samaritan, I mean, the priest went by and he said, "Well, I can't touch him. He's going to make me unclean. I'm, you know." So he passed by, and then the other guy passed by. Two people passed by, and then the Samaritan was the one who took care of the man. So the problem is, your laws are so important that you miss the point. The point is, care for one another and love one another in the need that's there presented before you.
Rose, Ed?
Yeah, I would like to know about the laws today. Why does the Christian church today feel that this does not apply to them to keep the holy days? How come they're done away with?
Well, that's actually probably a good thing to cover as we go through that.
Yeah, you know, talking about Christians and how they might do things differently. You know, in Leviticus, I think it's 21 verse 5, says, "They shall not make any baldness on their heads, nor shave off the edges of their beards, nor make any cuts in the flesh." Now, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts on the history of the Eastern Orthodox Church. And also, well, they also talk about Roman Catholicism, but it's mostly from the perspective of the Eastern Orthodox. And they actually talked about this concept of something called the tonsure, where the monks would actually shave the top of their head. Yeah, so the top of their head was bald, and then they would just have hair on the sides, like bangs, and they would just have like a little bit of hair like on their sides. And so it's almost like the polar opposite of this, where it says you shall not make any baldness on your head. And here they are actually specifically making a baldness on their head. They're priests, if you will. They're monks, you know, are doing this specifically to make themselves look different than the lay population. It's just like, I don't know where that 180 came from. I don't know. Weird.
Any other observations before we get going any further? Yes.
I would like you to explain the voluntary offerings and waving the sheaf. I don't know what they mean by that. I mean, you can say it in the scriptures, but I don't understand what the priests were doing.
Ah.
Does that make sense?
The wave offering? All right. Well, we had a number of questions. One of the things to kind of keep us focused as we go into taking a look at a number of these, and especially that key question of, well, what does our great high priest, how does that factor into this, especially when you made the observations of touching people with leprosy, touching people, dead bodies, etc. So how does that factor into this? And even if it's associating them. Yeah, exactly. So what do people do today with weeping sores and such? Well, one of the things that, remember, as we got started with the book of Leviticus, it was the idea of coming into the presence of God. Remember, we were talking about the end of Exodus. It leaves you with this point where God's presence moves in, everybody else had to move out. And so Leviticus keeps unfolding how you come into the presence of God. And one of the things we were talking about at the outset of this whole thing about holiness, your holiness, you're supposed to consecrate, holiness, consecrating, that's all about something that is set apart different from something else. And if you roll the tape back even further into Exodus, it was talked about that this whole tabernacle where the priests are doing all this stuff going on here is all about the pattern showed on the mountain. That's what all this was designed upon, and how the layout and such was going to go. So this was a place, the dwelling place of God, that this was a model for. And then you also had the presence of God coming and dwelling here for this. So one of the things that we should really keep in mind as we go into this is that this is a little mini picture, you could say today we was just talking about trailers of coming attractions. Well, this is the sanctuary was a trailer of what the world made new is going to be like, in that it is totally different from how things operate where we're at right now. Yes, you have a question?
We were reading about the high priest and the food. Now, was that in the sanctuary or was that for in his house?
As far as
who
eats what? Well, a lot of the things we're talking about with the eating from the offerings, that's like stuff that was done later after you bring the offerings in, and then you have portions of that go off to the priesthood.
So, but was that in the sanctuary and the veil?
It depends for what type of offerings, because some of them had to be eaten inside the tabernacle.
Right.
Some of them had a little bit more leeway for where they could be eaten. So again, this is all talking about a picture of the kingdom of God, which is like totally different from how things go on there. So you think in the kingdom of God, or even if you just roll it back to Genesis in the beginning, it talks about where there are like piles of corpses laying around Eden, just piled up, stacked up, you know, stepping over the corpses and stuff. No. In fact, you know, one of the things, the curses that you had, there was that, you know, in dying, you will die, or, you know, you will begin to die, basically, is another way to put that, was what that warning. Yeah, so the idea of there being, you know, death for humanity and such was something that came in at that point in time. So thus, when you start seeing this picture of the priesthood and the realm of God, it's not about corpses, and the idea of death is alien to the realm of God. So thus, when you fast forward the tape and you go back into Revelation and you see the end of Revelation, it talks about there'll be no more tears, no more death, you know, death will be thrown away. The whole thing of death will be gone. So that is what the prefiguring is looking like. It's the Creator is coming in and showing you a little picture here, this sanctuary and the priesthood of God, that this is a realm where death is very alien. It is to be set apart from the things that happen in God. So the tabernacle, the things that go on there, the people that serve there, what goes on there is set apart from these things that are alien. I mean, things die all the time around us and we think it's normal. Well, actually, we shouldn't think that it's normal. You know, because if you have a perspective of what things were like and what they're designed to be like, thus if something is happening completely different from that, it is alien, it's foreign, it's abnormal from what should be happening. You know, for example, you know, we talk about things that are illegal. Well, that is, you know, if you're driving down the road and the little sign there says 65, you know, and you look down at your odometer and it says 90, that's abnormal from the way that the laws there on the road are saying things should go. And it's one of those things that, you know, you look at even like in the picture of history, and you look back to the way perhaps people used to behave, and it was considered to be that was the correct way to behave and the way to treat each other. And thus, you know, if you have people punching each other, insulting each other, such like that, if you come from that time period of where things were like a, you know, more cordial, respectful of each other, then you come into a time period where people are nasty to each other, you would think the nastiness is abnormal. You're like, it shouldn't be like this. And that's really what the whole point of the tabernacle thing is, to really show Israel and through Israel the world that, hey, things shouldn't be like this. There's something else better that's coming along. And that's what the offerings, because remember we started Leviticus, we were talking about what the offerings are. It is like the word for offering, korban, is about to approach. So we are approaching the presence of God through these offerings. So thus, we are going from our broken, dying, you know, bodies the way they are now into to a time period and a place where all that stuff is now history. So it has to be different going in. So thus your avatar going in has to be different from that world of destruction, disease, decay, everything else going in. So that's why when you look at the offerings, they have to be unblemished. That's that whole thing of unblemished. And the priesthood, which are also the servants in bringing the people close, bringing them from away from God, from far off from God, to bringing them near, they're also operating in this realm of, you know, this pictured perfection of how things should be and how they will be again at some point in time. And so thus, that thing, the symbolism of the blemishes and such, also applies to them, to why they have to be unblemished as well. So it gets to a little bit of the question that was brought up there. Well, what about Yeshua? Claimed to be and said to be the Mashiach, and thus, you know, Hebrews talks about him as being our great high priest. So we read about this high priest and about the things related to priests not getting involved with the dead. You know, it's, you know, the regular priesthood, they could attend to their close family members, and if the close family members died, but the high priest, not even that. So that's one of those things. Well, then you have the dead that Yeshua is recorded to have raised from the dead. And then you also have the lepers that it records that he had touched, and kind of makes passing reference that he was healing other people in their sicknesses and diseases. So you wonder, well, what then is the difference with this? Yes.
But when he was on the earth, wasn't he the suffering servant instead of a high priest? That's his priestly office now, right?
Right. Well, the picture that we get, and that's what I was talking about, that's what the whole subject of the book of Hebrews is about, is the book of Hebrews is talking about a high priesthood that is higher than this. What we're looking at here is the Levitical priesthood, the Aaronic priesthood. And one of the big things that's developed in the book of Hebrews is that Yeshua is of this order called the Melchizedek priesthood, which is, you know, came before and operates even without a tabernacle. And you get this picture throughout Hebrews as to why, and Yeshua even talked about himself as to why it can operate without a physical tabernacle, because talks about his body is the tabernacle. Where, what is the tabernacle for? The dwelling place of God. So, yes.
Does the Melchizedek priesthood, does that abolish the Levitical, or does our Levitical stay the same?
Well, that's one of the things that is actually as a part of the, let me say, the Haftorah reading, which comes from Ezekiel. And the Haftorah reading goes into this picture looking off into the future of the Levitical priesthood again. Now, one of the things that the Levitical priesthood is all about is what? Bringing the gifts and the offerings in from the people, bringing them close. And then you also have this picture, you see it referenced in in Exodus 19, where they're getting ready to go up to the mountain, and talks about that to make you a kingdom of priests. And then you see the Apostle Peter also references that you are a kingdom of priests, a lively stone. So you get those kind of two imagery there of priests. Those are the ones that serve in the tabernacle. Then you get the picture of the lively stones actually being the building itself. So you get those dual images of servants in it, but also being the building itself. So thus, you're starting to talk about something that is has a, you could say, a greater picture of what's going on. Because again, the tabernacle is a picture of things going on, to pay attention to what God is doing. And then as the picture keeps getting bigger and bigger and clearer, you start seeing, oh, this is what God is doing. So thus, when you talk about the Levitical priesthood, they operate in the tabernacle, still bringing the gifts in. We talk, well, is the tabernacle? Well, the tabernacle is continuing on in the body of Messiah. So one of the things we'll actually get to is the continual, there's this, one of the instructions in here is talking about respecting the sons of Aaron, or respecting the priests going forward. And that's one of those pictures that you show. You can see that there is respect that you give just because of the position that someone is given. But, you know, sometimes the person that actually is holding that office may not be either aware of what role they're serving, or maybe is not the best, but you still show the respect for the office as much as possible. You know, for example, that's kind of pictured there in Leviticus 21:8, where it talks about, says, you shall consecrate them, so talking about the priest there, for he offers the food of your God. He shall be holy to you, for I, the Lord, who sanctifies you, am holy. So this setting these priests apart is different, you know, treating them as being set apart, something to continue on, you know, even if there is no tabernacle. So thus, when you even get down to the point of the first century, there was a building, the temple there, and there was someone who was appointed high priest, you know, questionable as to how connected they were to the family of, you know, Aharon at that point in time, because they tended to, well, after the Maccabean period, there was a little bit of things went one way and another way. And so as to when you get to the first century, the office of the high priest became more political. So that's one of those things that, and you saw how they operated. And there's even recorded aspects of what the high priests of the period were doing. So one of the things that Paul talks about there in Acts chapter 23, when he's brought in before the Sanhedrin, and he actually, you know, dresses down one of the Sanhedrin for the way they're acting. It's recorded in the first five verses of Acts 23. And, you know, he gets a reprimand saying, hey, you know, this is the high priest. He repents and says, yeah, I repent because, and then he quotes there from Exodus 22:28, says, you know, not revile the leader among your people. So it's like that guy who was operating in that office was high priest. Paul was recognizing, okay, you hold that office. You deserve the respect of that office, even if, you know, you're not acting in a respect-worthy manner. You're not being a faithful shepherd. So, I mean, it's a big... We talked about it in our last go-round with the Torah section, but one of the things that it has a direct bearing for us today is that we have to be really respectful of people who are, you could say, the appointed leaders. Because one of the things that is revealed there in the Word is that people are put up, whether they're directly lifted up to their position or allowed to rise to their position. God doesn't tell us specifically. He tells us sometimes he raised them up specifically, like Cyrus there in Persia. But some of these people who are raised up are not great people. I mean, Cyrus, when you read back in history, terrible. I mean, he was an unbelievable tyrant. But it was the side effect of one of the things that he did. You can talk about whether he, you know, had the ear, how much he was actually listening to, but what he accomplished, he was anointed is what he's called. He's called a Mashiach. He is anointed. He was anointed to do a very specific thing, and that was to get the exiles going back and to get the temple rebuilt and get Yerushalayim, you know, reoccupied again. So we have another question over here.
How could the high priest slaughter the lamb and still be clean?
How could the high priest slaughter the lamb and still be clean? Oh, touch a dead body. Ah, well, that's one of those things that it wasn't dead when the offering first came in. And it's one of those things of the picture that's involved here of the offering. It's not just, you know, God's big barbecue. It's about what is the picture of things that are happening. What is the picture of the
blood?
Yes, and then takes the blood, because remember, it's talking about the life is in the blood. You know, you could say, well, okay, well, it's dead and it's already starting to sort of decay. You could say that. But the point is that the blood is what the symbol associated with the life of the animal. So it's the life that, and again, it's the life of the person who is coming through to approach God. And you see the greater picture of that's then revealed both at the time of the first Pesach, and then down also, as you see it in Isaiah, foretold there of the coming Messiah. And then finally, with the Yeshua coming, that this picture of this blood, this life, and, you know, death of the innocent, the blood and the life, then actually helping people get closer to God and to cover over all the ickiness that the people came out of from the world to get close to God, that was the picture, you know, pointing to one of the things that the Messiah did, which is when you talk about priests bringing offerings to God, there's no greater role than the one that Yeshua played.
Two comments. One, it was as far as just like the priest, okay, the animal was alive, he touched it, of course now it's dead, yada yada yada. But it wasn't dead when he touched it. Messiah is the exact same, it's just flipped reverse. The person's unclean until I touch them, then they're clean. So, well, he obviously didn't become unclean because what he touched is clean. So he's clean, what he touched was clean, it's all clean still. So the person may have started out unclean. When he touched them, they're not. So they become clean and he's not unclean. He didn't touch an unclean thing. That's one point. It's a play on, you know, concept. But the other thing is I want to point a comment which Jeff had mentioned a couple of ways. The way I look at this pretty typically is that the Torah and the instructions for the Levitical priesthood, how the temple operates, all that stuff is strictly a picture. It's not the actual real thing. It's just
pattern.
An image.
The
it's
pattern.
An idea.
Yeah.
It's just an image. That's all it is. So it has no authority of its own, has no strength of its own, it has nothing of its own. It's just a picture. And it repeats over and over and over again throughout the Torah that, hey, this is a picture of what Moses was shown up in the sky, as he pointed out already. So the real thing is in the heavens. That's what really is true. The stuff here in the Torah is just a picture. It's It's just an image, just to give us an idea of what truth actually is. So whether or not the priest, besides the fact that the priest couldn't make someone alive and touched him, unlike Messiah, that's a huge difference. But the priest don't touch a dead body because it's a picture of don't bring death into what is holy, what is clean. That's the whole point. And then the heaven is not going to accept death inside of heaven. Will death be there? Of course not. So that's the whole idea, that the real thing's up there, the fake stuff's down here. It's just an image, just an idea.
Yeah, because one of the things that you might have seen, the trope that's been going around for probably a good 15, 20 years now, started out in kind of like email form, actually started fax form, but then when email started coming around, people were bringing this list of the things that basically the contradictions and things inside, mostly inside the Torah, that show that God is reprehensible. And actually one of them comes from this particular passage that we're looking at. And it's like, well, you know, what is this whole thing about God casting out people with defects? You know, like me, I would, if I were a Cohen, I would not be allowed in because my eyesight is defective. So thus I wouldn't be allowed in. So what are all these other people? You know, you're short, one, you know, was it your fault that you were born with a defect or something happened to you in some sort of a process? And the accusation there made is that, oh, you're not allowed to worship God if you have a defect. That is not the point of the whole tabernacle thing. Right. Yeah, they're still allowed to eat from the sacrifices, you know, still get sustained. Yes, and that actually came to be a problem when you talk about garbage in the sacrifices. When you read Isaiah, you know, a lot of people have gotten the wrong idea, thinking that God didn't want the sacrifices. But what is he railing against? When you read several chapters of Isaiah, he's talking about, what are you bringing in these lame, you know, defected offerings in here? You know, would you bring your wife or whatever, a wilted bouquet of flowers, you know, rotten. Yeah, exactly. She'd hit you with it. Yes.
Okay, well, I had one and then that kind of brought something else. So on the first thing I was going to say with touching the unclean thing, all of a sudden you're touching a dead carcass now. You killed it, but you're still touching a dead carcass. Even Messiah admits that the priest profaned the Sabbath by serving.
Yep.
So what it made me think of is there are things that God commands the priests to do that are against the rest of the laws that really apply to everybody else, only for a specific purpose. And one of the main things in my mind is that the high priesthood is supposed to be a picture of us, of Messiah. Messiah healed people on the Sabbath and got yelled at for it. There were lots of things he did on the Sabbath, lots of things he did in general that he got yelled at for, because the people in his time also had an incorrect view of what Messiah was supposed to look like. So, you know, God set the priests aside, and he also set the high priest aside from the other priests, as a picture to us. You know, there was going to be one that came along that could do these things and make the things clean instead of being profaned by them when he did it. And then on the thing with the defects, on one hand, I can think, you know, sometimes depending on depending on the defect the person was born with, it could be a relief for them not to have these requirements. But then the other thing, again, we're going back to the picture. Messiah has absolutely zero blemishes. And these people who were supposed to serve, they were supposed to be a picture to us of what Messiah would look like. He would have no blemishes.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about the old rabbinical argumentation form called Baal Gachomer, which means from light to heavy. You see that used in Hebrews all the time. You know, if this is true, well, how much more than this? Well, when we look in today's society, we talk about a great representation, what the high priest represents. If you have someone that we hold up with high, great honor, like some sort of head of state or something like that, what is usually their protective detail and such like? Do they pick any Joe Schlub, you know, guy kind of frumpled and this and that and the other? No, they're going to pick the absolute cream of the crop. You're going to go through all kinds of weeding out processes to get into that elite team of this and that and the other. Why? Because it is a showing of how significant that role is, that there is such a weeding out process that goes, and how, you could say, set apart that great head of state is from everybody else because of the high echelon of those who are around it. You know, we think of our the tomb of the unknown soldier. I mean, my dad worked at the Pentagon for a certain point in time. It was part of the office where they actually picked people for the guard the tomb of the unknown soldier. And wow, that was a very narrow definition of the people who fit that bill, who could just stand there in the cold at attention, moving nothing, even though there's a pile of snow on their head. That role was very, very narrow and very, very strict. Hardly anybody fit that in the armed services, even among elite armed services. So it is. Yeah, and plus, you know, every denomination or whatever has these sorts of people who are held up. You know, we have various pastors who show up on TV and have giant congregations and such. That's right. So when you talk about when you talk about the weak and the base things, you know, the key thing of why most of the prophets tended to be disregarded is they were a lot of times in the outs group. I mean, there were some of the great prophets who came from esteemed families and such, but for a good portion of it, think of Eliyahu and you think of Yochanan or John the Baptist, those people were seen as outsiders, not really people worthy of respect. And Yeshua himself, you know, well, where did you come from? Who'd you study under? Yet, it's what is the message that's coming through in the process? And that, when we talk about the picture of the tabernacles and the priesthood, that's a big thing, topic when you read the prophets, is that, okay, you're standing there in this position, you're held up with this great honor of being a part of the priesthood, yet, who are you really? And what are you actually doing? What role are you actually serving? And that's why I would like to kind of take a little bit of a detour as we were talking about these rules for the priesthood, is to look over here in a couple of definitions for shepherds that God talked about here in talking about the apostolic writings for shepherds. But you also see talked about in the prophets also about the shepherds of Israel and the shepherds of Israel leading them astray, whether that be the king at the particular time period or leaders of the people. So you had a thing before we get going to this?
Yeshua was jumping all over the scribes and Pharisees. They invited him to dinner, and then it started when he didn't wash his hands. And then he just slam, slam, slam. And that's my favorite part. I'm like, yeah, go, Yeshua! You know, because he said, you know, you have missed the whole point. Mercy. Gentleness, but you're so busy with your traditions, you don't even, you know what I mean?
Because one of the interesting things is the passage from Mark 7, is that what they're referring to, or is that one of the other ones? Oh, Matthew. Yeah. But one of the great things that you see in a lot of these, you'd say, butting heads examples that Yeshua had with some of the leadership at the time period was a practice that mentioned this in previous times, but the Pedroshim or the Pharisees, they a good thing they did, and also a source of challenge and problems, was that they took a number of the practices that related to the priesthood and to the tabernacle and made spiritual applications for the common people, where we get the whole synagogue to begin with, is something that they brought forward, this idea of the mini tabernacle that everybody could go into, not just the priesthood. Some of the practices of the priesthood, such as, you know, the washing hands and various things that the priesthood would be doing, were things that they applied to the common people. Now, again, as a discipline, you could say, oh, that would be a kind of a good idea. You think kingdom of priests and this and that. However, one of the problems that came in is then to start wagging your finger at somebody and saying, why aren't you doing this? Just like you see in Mark 7. Why aren't your students washing their hands? Well, it's not in the Torah to go wash for the common people to go wash their hands. Good idea, yes. Great spiritual discipline, yes. But don't start saying your students, and by extension, you are evil, because you're not commanding that your students do this. So one of the, I don't know if that kind of addresses what you're talking about a bit. Yeah. So that's one of the great challenges that comes in taking a lot of what we're reading here in this parasha today. And there's lots of great spiritual lessons that you can get from this. But again, remember who this is talking to specifically. This is talking to specifically the priesthood, and in a section of it, talking to the high priest. So, which, even if you're talking about the Kohanim in general, one that's been totally set aside using what the Torah talks about with the red heifer, not done. Hasn't been done for 2,000 years. So, yeah, so when you talk about the kind of the red heifer experience, I guess number 19, I guess where it talks about the red heifer and what the red heifer is used for. Interestingly, talking about dead bodies and the high priest. Totally coincidentally, yes. Totally coincidentally talking about that. But let's turn over to some passages here in the apostolic writings that talk about some instructions that the Apostle Paul brings forward relating to, you could say, the general terms of shepherds or overseers or deacons. But you'll probably notice that some of these sound quite similar to what we've been reading in our parasha today. So we're going to start with 1 Timothy chapter 3 and the first 13 verses. It is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. An overseer, then, must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, but gentle, peaceable, free from the love of money. He must be the one who manages his own household well, keeping his children under control with all dignity. But if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how will he take care of the assembly of God? And not a new convert, so that he will not be conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. And he must have a good reputation with those outside the assembly, so that he will not fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. The deacons, likewise, must be men of dignity, not double-tongued or addicted to much wine or fond of sordid gain, but holding to the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience. These men must also first be tested, then let them serve as deacons if they are beyond reproach. Women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips, but temperate, faithful in all things. Deacons must be husbands of only one wife and good managers of their children and their own households. For those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a high standing and great confidence in the faith that is in Messiah Yeshua. And there's a kind of a companion instruction that's given over in Titus chapter 1. Yeah, talking about leaders. And when it talks about overseer and deacon, it's kind of interesting. You probably recognize the the term there for overseer, the Greek word is episkopos. You know, or you might have heard like the Episcopal congregation. The episkopos is the Greek word, and from that you kind of get the idea of the bishop is one there. And yes, San Luis Obispo. And diakonos is the Greek word where we get deacon from. They just kind of just ported the word right over into English. And diakonos is the idea of servant, or basically a servant in there. So it's kind of interesting because they would be the ones that would be serving the assembly. Sometimes you... Well, you see, these might be, you know, similar to actually what you see the young Samuel. He was kind of being groomed for a greater role, but yeah, just we have people who are taking care. So basically, we're servants. So yeah, and the servants. Right, because one of the things you have to remember is that Stephen was considered a deacon, and he gave one of the most fantastic sermons ever. We talk about just the pinnacle of sermons. His sermon there, recorded in Acts, is unbelievable. So, it's one of the first and actually the last recorded sermons of Stephen. Wow. Yes.
Well, one thing I noticed right away is that I think we need to be careful about conflating the instructions the Apostle Paul that he's given to both Timothy and Titus, and conflating those issues with the instructions of Leviticus in this one sense. He's not talking to priests.
No.
And he is not imposing the standards of priest upon these leaders that he's talking to, either Timothy or Titus or any of those that might fill their role later on. Because, for example, you know, he talks about the instructions for these men and also for their wives. And you notice in here, he never says once anything about that they cannot be married to divorced women or cannot marry widows or anything like that. So let's be careful about conflating the two issues. These are totally separate roles. But Paul is setting a high standard for these men and their wives. But this is not a priestly role he's giving them, because as Paul says over and over again in other areas, we already have a priest. We have one high priest,
yes.
And that is it.
And see, that is one of the points of bringing this up, is that what we're seeing here in these passages is, you would say, under the hood of what we were reading in Leviticus. These are what the people who are serving in these roles should be like. And when you read kind of later on with, you know, Eli or Eli and with the problems he had, and of course, you know, Aharon and problems with his sons and such, you can see where some of the subtexts of the instructions that Paul is giving just to leaders of a congregation or servants in a congregation is that, you know, it's, don't just plop you in a role, or even with the priesthood, you know, I am a Kohanim by birth, and so thus, you know, you must respect me. It's like, well, yeah, God says I must respect you, but remember who it is you serve and what you should be living up to. And so that's when you see the leadership role that Paul is getting at with these passages, it's what is your heart situation like when you approach these roles? Do you approach these roles like, I'm the big cheese and you got to do what I say? Or is this the role of, you could say, following after your master, the suffering servant? And that's kind of what you see, the subtext of these instructions here. You'll see them even more here in the passage we're looking at in Titus. We're looking at chapter 1, verses 5 through 16. For this reason I left you in Crete, that you would set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you. Namely, if any man is above reproach, husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. For the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, pugnacious or fond of sordid gain, but hospitable, loving what is good, sensible, just, devout, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, so that he will be able both to exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict. For there are many rebellious men, empty talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, who must be silenced because they are upsetting whole families, teaching things they should not teach for the sake of sordid gain. One of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, "Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons." This testimony is true. For this reason, reprove them severely so that they may be sound in the faith, not paying attention to Jewish myths and commandments of men who turn away from the truth. To the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure, but both their mind and their conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny him, being detestable and disobedient, worthless for any good deed. And that's also a part you might have recalled in the parasha that we're talking about here. The passage is right near the end of, I believe it's 22. Yeah, there in Leviticus 22, verse 32, where it talks about, you know, do not profane the name of God, but sanctify the name of God. So that's a part of the, you know, we talked about before of the, where it's talking about profane. This is the Hebrew term of halal, not halal, but halal. The Hebrew verb halal means, it literally means to like poke or perforate, to, you know, to wound or injure. But metaphorically, it means to kind of drag down, to sully, to make not as good as it was before. So that's what you get that picture when it talks about profaning the name of God. And then kind of the opposite term, so kind of the negative commandment there is don't profane, don't poke holes in the reputation of God. But on the other side, to sanctify, to make separate, to make distinct the name of God. Because, you know, the term for name or shem, very similar to, we have the concept in English and probably Western culture, probably hard to say. You know, a lot of Western culture has been built up on the tradition that comes from the Bible, so kind of hard to say where things just came up otherwise. But in a lot of Western culture, and even actually Eastern culture, if you look into it, the idea of reputation, your name is hugely about reputation. What it means when you, even today, if you just say, well, what is your name? Someone asks you, well, what is your name? Like, if they're going to vote, you're going to vote and they ask you for your name. So you give them your name. Why? That distinguishes you from the person behind you and the person who came in before you. It sets you apart as being distinct from that other person. You know, probably the more distinct the name comes and they ask for an address and they ask for other things, well, at least they should, but that is an idea of setting something apart as being distinct. So when we talk about the name of God, it is what sets God apart as distinct, either from the nations around or the way things commonly work today. You know, so when we talk about profaning the name of God, a lot of that is about how you act. So Paul's instructions to these leaders, these overseers of these congregations, and to the priesthood themselves, you talk about, you know, when God was talking here back in the Torah to these priests, they have to treat the reputation of God as being distinct. Just don't sit back and say, well, I am a priest of God. Well, how is it that you act that tells me about this God? Or the way you act, is that a reflection upon who God is? You see, you know, later on in the writings, where you see these, I think it was actually the sons of Eli, now that I think about it. They were officiating there, and their behavior with people who would frequent the front of the entrance to the house of God was so reprehensible that people didn't want to go there anymore. And you have to wonder about how far that goes into what people think about God himself, if God's servants are behaving like that. It kind of reflects badly upon who it is there. So thus, when you see these instructions for the heads of congregations, and even, again, you know, it's one of those things that just with the priests could also apply to the people, not specifically talking to the people, but saying, look, if the priests are held to this standard, maybe this is a way of behavior that we all should shoot for. To even to the, you could say, distilled to the basic elements of, you got to be trustworthy, you're not running around, you're not back-talking on people, you're not stabbing them in the back. So these kinds of principles that you could say apply to priests of the house of God, being the tabernacle, the pattern of God, then filtering down to the head of a given congregation. Then you could say filtering down even into the head of a given household. How is it that you behave inside the house? Because, you know, one of those things you'll notice that is a instruction to these overseers is that you manage your household well and that the children are behaved and such. Is it, it's like everybody has free will and people can go off and behave as they will. But it's one of those things, did you start them out in the right direction? And did the way that you run the household kind of reflect on the direction that that the children took later in life? As I grew up in a household that extended household that was very permissive in behavior. So thus, it was really no mystery that some of my extended family just ran wild. I mean, it was really no mystery at all at that happened. One thing, if you are showing and modeling good behavior and being that kind, respectful leader, showing the way that things should go, but it's quite another, you just kind of let people do whatever, find their own path, and then people go off and do their own thing, and you wonder, well, what happened? Yes?
I was going to say, that's definitely important, but sometimes that can be deceiving as well. You know, sometimes you have to look at what the relationship is between the children and the parent, because there's also parents that exasperate their children and they behave exactly how they're supposed to in public. Everything looks fine, but it's actually not.
Yes, the stereotypical pastor's kid. Yeah, I can't tell you how many times that is the case. It's like, wow, they look like the model citizen until look out. Yeah, look out. So it's one of those things that, you know, what is it that you're actually modeling? And, you know, again, when you talk about the reputation of God, you know, it's one of those things to look in inside a glass house and throw stones outside of it. But again, you really have to wonder, well, what is God being modeled like that the kids would not want to have anything to do with God whatsoever?
Well, I can tell you that it's been a slow process for me, but I used to drive my kids crazy. I did, and I didn't realize it.
I used to drive my parents crazy, yeah.
And then they were afraid to say something to me because I thought I'd get mad. And I'm like, hey, I'm trying to change here. I mean, it's okay. Right now, I'm not going to get mad. So just tell me everything. And then they do, and I'm like, gosh, am I that bad? And they're like, yeah.
Want me to write a list?
Yeah, and yeah, I know that I did notice a big change in my parents. So it's one of those things that when change does happen, it is noticed. So that's one of the great things that we have, and I guess it's a good picture of what it is that God does in transforming us. You know, if those around us can see our change, we can see changes in our family, and our kids and our relatives can see the change inside of us, then we talk about reflection upon the name of God. That is huge. That says a whole lot. And when you see over the long, long history of the people of God throughout time, that is one of the, quote, calling cards of God's power, is that transformation. Transformation of whole people, transformation of people inside, transformations of generations, transformations of they have the mention here a few times in the parasha that we're looking at today about foreigners and aliens. So these are people that have come to be associated with God through various means, either by they were in countries that were around where Israel was. They did trade with Israel. They, you know, came in through the indentured servitude, various ways that they came in contact. But, you know, kind of like you would say, like children of a family, what message did they get in that process? They're like, wow, I'm glad we're gone. Never want to see that again. Or they're like, wow, we want to know more. And that picture that you see in the great final Sukkot of wanting to go up year after year to celebrate with God. So you might wonder, well, what on earth are, you know, Leviticus 23 with the great description of all of the Moedim, all the appointed times of God, what on earth does that have to do with all of these things related to the priest? Because it's kind of like sandwiched on either side. You've got two chapters, 21, 22, and then 24 following, more instructions for the priesthood. Then you've got kind of in the middle this kind of list of the appointments that are happening. Because remember again, the picture of all this is the pattern that was showed of God's kingdom that was showed on the mountain. This is what is going on. You could say in symbolic form with the things happening with the priests and the offerings, but also with symbols in time as well.
Well, I think the reason that they might be that, you know, that you're seeing Leviticus 21 and 22, then 24 is all these instructions about how the priests are to act and da-da-da. Why is the Moedim sandwiched in the middle? Because it kind of reminds, I think it's because it kind of reminds the priests what all of this is for. And a lot of what this is for them to conduct themselves in the practice of these Moedim. So you're not told, oh, you can only do that. You can only marry this kind of woman, or you can only do this and that. It's not just for the sake of, oh, I can only marry this kind of woman or this and that. There's a point to it. And part of the point to it is the office of handling the Moedim. You're not following these rules just for the sake of following rules. You have a job to do, and this is one of your jobs.
Interesting. Yes. So when you think about the jobs that they had to do, one of those was related to the appointments in time. And these appointments, you think of that there was a specific place where all this was going on. It's often called in Hebrew the place, the makom, the place where this happens, where the tabernacle is called. Well, Moed or Moedim, these are the times, the appointed times. So it's like, okay, this is the location where this happens. Now, with Leviticus 23, is these are the times where things happen.
Why do we still keep the appointed times?
Aha. So I was just going to get to that, because that was one of the questions we had at the outset, was that, well, what is the Moedim? What purpose do they have if you have like no place and no priesthood to carry these out? I know one of the things that's often brought up, well, when you look at Leviticus 23, you've got talking about wheat and all kinds of crops and this and that. So if you're not talking about an agricultural society, you're not talking about being in the land, then what on earth does this all have to do with anything? So that's the question that first came up. Before we get to that, do you have a comment?
For me, I'm getting the picture that we're practicing for the kingdom, and we have to have behavior that's appropriate so we can be let in through Messiah. We're going to be examined very closely. And that, well, that's what Heavenly Father's been showing me this week. It's, I need to watch my thoughts. I need to watch what I say and what I think and what I do. I need to do what he asked me to do because I want to enter the kingdom. I want to be a part of this kingdom. And we're not going to just be loosely let in. We will be examined.
So when you see in Leviticus 23, it starts out with Shabbat and it talks about Pesach, and then it's the Bikurim, and then the Matzot, and then the Shavuot, and then it continues on with the Teruah, or the trumpets, and then it goes on to Kippurim, then to Oats, and kind of also in that is Atzeret. Yeah, so as you'll notice in there, it doesn't talk in this passage about the new moon celebration. It's like specifically mentioned in, I guess, greater detail in Numbers chapter 10, but in this list of them, they're not mentioned, although mentioned quite a lot. So it's like, that's very odd. There, the new moon is mentioned, I guess you could say, by point of reference in that you'll see it actually mentioned quite a lot in here. It's that on the first of this month, on the 14th day of the month, you know, and here the first day, well, there's one again. So the new moon is basically the subtext of a lot of what is talked about in Leviticus 23, but not mentioned in specifically among the ones that are here. One of the things that you'll, we talked a little bit in passing about this, is that when the ones that we have mentioned in the first month, and then you have all these that are mentioned in the seventh month, what they have to do with us today is they continue to be a hallmark, you know, looking back on our history, what God has been doing, but also looking to the present of what God is doing with us, and then looking to the future of what God is doing. So, you know, if you just kind of look at these things one by one, and for example, with Pesach, what is the primary thing of Pesach? Passover, Egypt, you know, getting out of Egypt, getting on out, right? So there you go. There's past, the ancient past. But then there's also the Pesach for those of us as believers in Yeshua's Messiah. It is also the remembrance of the death of Messiah. So that's two big things in there as well. And then when at the, you know, Last Supper is it called, he often talks about, I look forward to having this together with you in the kingdom. So it's also kind of looking forward. So you've got Pesach is both ancient past, you know, not so more ancient past, and then you've got also the future. So with ancient Israel, with Messiah, and then with Messiah again in the kingdom made new. So you have a question here? Ah, well, we'll get to that next. Bikurim, Bikur is just the sprouting forth. So the Bikurim is the idea of its first fruits. That's another way to put it in common parlance. Well, one of the, you could kind of transpose them back and forth, depending on your thing there. Right. But it's one of those things that when you talk about what relevance does this have with us today, is that what was the first relevance of it? The first relevance of it was getting out. It's called the bread of haste, the bread of affliction. You had to get out, just keep moving, keep moving, keep moving, and until you could stop. So thus, matzot is it's part of Just as Pesach was deliverance, Matzot also a part of the deliverance. It's a 7 days of remembering that you have been taken out. And seven also, back also with Shabbat, Shabbat coming every 7 days, picture of creation, but also picture of completion, because Shabbat and Shavuah, which you have the number seven comes from, is also a word for oath. And kind of the earlier uses of it with oath and seven comes from the time of Yaakov or Jacob and his wells. And it talks about that is the place of the oath or the place of the Shavuah, is the place of the seven. So the number seven and oath, this is something sure that you can, you know, take it to the bank. The symbol of seven comes in there. So Shabbat, every seventh day of creation, and 7 days of Matzot. So when we talk about a deliverance, one of the things that Matzot points back to is we remember that God delivered ancient Israel, got us started. Our forefathers were delivered. Now we think of us personally. We personally were delivered. Partially? No, completely. That's what seven is about. We were totally delivered from our Egypt. Now, one of the things that you see in the story of Israel kind of headed towards Sinai is that the the people bodily may have left Egypt, but sometimes they're, you know, I left my heart in San Francisco. Some of them left their heart in Egypt still. And yeah, left it back there and leaks and everything else, and they kept longing for it over time. And Apostle Paul writes a lot about that. Keep lingering and longing over the things of our old life. He calls it the old man keeps rearing up. Our old way of life keeps rearing up. But one of those things that to remember is that God delivered us out. And he considers us delivered. It's part of that big 50-cent word, justification. It just means declared not guilty. He considers us to be delivered from it. So why should we drag that back in again, thinking that we're not delivered and God has something against us, when God says, no, covered that. So, you know, Bikurim, picture of it in the first, you know, the Exodus, but more of it in the terms of the land itself. That's coming into the land itself, and that getting the crops of the land. God's going to give you the crops of the new land. And then also in the time of Messiah, picture of Bikurim being the point of resurrection, the close connection of resurrection of our Savior with that. So agricultural, yes, but agricultural with a lesson. And then God confirmed it by actually having a huge event in the history of all mankind and the whole universe happen related to that. So Bikurim is an anniversary of that. It's an anniversary of the resurrection. Pesach, death. Bikurim, resurrection. And then pointed forward to Shavuot, an ancient history that's about a time period closely associated with their arrival at Sinai, and then agriculture related to a great harvest. A celebration of the first harvests of the land. And as we talked a couple of weeks ago about John chapter 4, it's a picture of the harvest is a not just talking about crops, but also talking about people. And that God is seeing what he's doing here is a harvest of the earth. And, you know, grain doesn't just kind of, you know, we can go down to the store and get bread, but it doesn't grow in the ground as loaves of bread. It starts out as plants and then it matures into this and that. And it's really kind of a picture of ourselves as a crop of God, but also the world too, maturing into something. And also you could say the a greater people of God maturing into something that can be harvested. And so that picture, and then of course the parallel we could say at the time of Messiah is Acts chapter 2 with Pentecost, Shavuot happening there. So it's a great picture of God, this great harvest, the 2,000 people who decided that they would trust in God and God's Messiah on that given day. So that's the picture there. So ancient history, history related to the Messiah. So when we see the things that they come down, you know, Messiah and the great hallmarks of his mission there came the first time, related here to the things that happened in the first month. Bam, 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 bam. You know, death on Pesach, you know, resurrection on Bikurim, and then you have the Shavuot with the Spirit of God coming with power. So then when you look down into the seventh month, these are pictures of things in Israel's history, but also things that are related to, you could say, symbols of things yet to come. Things that have happened, will happen, is a mixture of them. Because when you see the triumphal entry, and also the triumphal entry of Yeshua into Yerushalayim, you see there's palm branches. Palm branches are a typical symbol of Sukkot there at the time of Pesach. So you'll see a number of these symbols blended together. You'll see the Yochanan the Baptist. He talks about the Lamb of God, Pesach, who takes away the sins of the world, the goat of Kippurim. So those together being things that are happening. So when you talk about the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, those are the two things. The one who blocks the destroyer of God, the one who blocks the wrath of God in Pesach, and who covers over the sins, transgressions, and iniquity of the people. So God can consider us justified, not guilty. Our old thing of atonement, Kippurim, that's what the word means. Kippur means to cover. Kippur means covering. Things are covered. Our icky stuff is covered. So with the seventh month, you've got pictures of Teruah and HaKippurim, or Day of Atonement, and then Sukkot with their tabernacles, and then Shemini Atzeret, which is the eighth day, day after of Sukkot. So you had the picture of seven again. We talked about seven meaning completeness and things reaching a completion. You have the picture of trumpets, final call going out. You see pictures of that throughout Israel's history about a call to come out. You might kind of ring some bells about talking about Yeshua, talking about the last trumpet. Paul also writes about the last trumpet, and also the in Revelation, lots of trumpets, seven trumpets, and also there's some one of those calls to come out. So this crying out of in the final completion of things, that's throughout lots of stuff in the prophets about it. It's foretold at the end of Deuteronomy. Prophets talk about it, the Messiah talks about it. A picture of the completion of God's work. Now, when you think about Kippurim, well, is that future, present, past? And the question is, yes. That's all of the above. As you know, there have been some people might have heard like the Millerite movement back in the mid-1800s. Well, that was related to Kippurim and the Day of Atonement, and thinking that that related to the Second Coming. Well, when you read the book of Hebrews, Book of Hebrews is big on Day of Atonement. It's a huge subject of the Day of Atonement. Lots and lots of talk about the Day of Atonement in the Book of Hebrews. But what is the Book of Hebrews about? The high priest has done it and is sitting at the right hand of God. So Kippurim is about ancient past, Israel, ancient Israel time, talking about Messiah past, meaning something that Messiah did there with what he accomplished. And then also talking about future. When you talk about the total completion of all things, when God takes sin and death and throws that, destroys that in the lake of fire, and that's all done away with. It's all covered over. That's the final completion, the final covering of it all. So as you read through the prophets, you read through Revelation, once all that stuff gets done, then what happens? Revelation 21, 22. I saw the city of God descending out. Yes. So Sukkot, the dwelling of mankind, or the dwelling of God with mankind, the Emmanuel, God with us, that is finally realized. But Sukkot also, ancient history, is what is this originally talked about? Because you dwelled in booths, because when you were coming out of Egypt, you were dwelling in booths, and then you dwelled in tents, temporary shelters, for 40 years until God brought you to a permanent home, Sukkot. And that's the picture of Sukkot, is the coming from the temporary home to the permanent home. And the permanent home being, you know, when it talks about there in Revelation, now the dwelling of God is with mankind. That picture, we talk about patterns in the beginning of the tabernacle. Well, where was the tabernacle? Tabernacle, right smack dab, right in the middle of the camp of Israel. Right in the middle of it. And why did he say that? Is because he says, I want to dwell in the midst of my people. But so you got that kind of tension there. And he says, I can't dwell in the midst of the people because of their ugliness. But he says, I want to dwell in the midst of the people. Just like at the end of Exodus, where it's like, okay, build me a tent. He moves into the tent. Everybody has to get out. And then he starts telling you, okay, now this is how you come back in. Because in the end, God wants to dwell with mankind. Why? And talks about what is the greatest gift. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. That is the heart passion of God. God's Messiah is to dwell with mankind, to bring those who are far off, we're all far off as humans, back close, to set right the things that God started. So the picture of all this here with the tabernacle and the priests and everything else is all about hitting the big reset button to the way that God had created it. But the question is that do we want to live that way? Do we want to live a way back with the creator of all things? And well, that's sometimes it's a question that takes a lifetime to understand and kind of fully come to grips with it. Because it is a question just like the people coming out of Egypt. You want to get out of Egypt? Yeah! But then you realize, oh, what does that mean? Yeah, it means the way the things ran back there in Egypt, that's not really the best way things should run anymore. And, you know, for some it takes a lifetime, really for all of us it takes a lifetime to fully make that transformation. And it comes another big 50-cent word, which is called sanctification. Oh yeah, I think they talked about that with the priests. Yeah, well that's what happens really with all of us. We're all kind of set aside, or given the antidote to the world around us. And it takes really a whole lifetime to take effect. Thankfully, it happens in a big order, and hopefully pretty quickly, where we can see that change within ourselves, and other people can see that change within us, and that the reputation of God as being the better way to go can really go out into the world around us. So, yes. We should behave in the way, in the way the Father wants us to,
by being obedient to Him and living the way He wants us to, then that does make us different.
Because what is one of the things that prophesied? It's a great picture in the prophets. It's in that song that we sing on a lot of Shabbats, Teshuvah, and it says that, and it quotes from the prophets on one of those, that in the last days that the people will come and they'll grab hold of the fringes or the tzitzit of one Jew and says, yeah, we've heard God's with you. Well, how do they know that? Because the way you lived before that. You know, it's not like, oh, it's those God people. It's like, oh, who's those God people? That's the answer that we need. So that is the thing when you talk about the pattern showed on the mountain. This is not just busy work and a giant slaughterhouse. This is about showing that really this is a drastic change that has to happen in the way the world has been going. And not many people actually come and realize that. That the way that the world is going really should be different. People should be treating each other quite differently. So are there any last thoughts as we kind of wrap up here? I don't know, Rose, if that kind of gets to the question that you were bringing out. Well, does this have any sort of relevance when we talk about Leviticus 23? Does it have any relevance to believers in Messiah today? Because we go through them, they're all tied into the whole history of Israel. But,
I know the relevance. I've been doing this for a long time.
Yes.
But my question is, why doesn't the mainstream Christianity get the importance of keeping these days? Why are they saying that, oh, Christ came and, he done away with all that stuff?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. Probably today, one of the key reasons is because that's the way that many pastors, teachers have been taught. That's probably the most common reason. For those that actually do know, it probably goes back to the same things that started back in the days of really the first century. When you start reading some of the writings in the late first century, early second century, where you had those that didn't grow up around all this, call it the Gentiles, people out in the greater Greek world, they didn't grow up around the things of God, and so they kind of came into the knowledge of God and to the Messiah and started blending things together. And then over time, you started to have also something that grew up with a tension between, you know, those who were natural born Israel or the converts who didn't believe in the Messiah, and then those that were antagonistic against this persecution, kind of like what Paul was doing. You see the early part of Acts as he was going after people. That caused a big rift. You saw when God turned him around that there were a number of people that were scared of him. They didn't want to have anything to do with him, kept their distance from him. Well, there was also people that were quite hateful of that kind of treatment. And then later on, as the believers in Messiah became more entrenched, he almost became the civic religion of what in the waning days of the Roman Empire, then they started to kind of, I wouldn't say lash out, but kind of put a boot down upon these people of Israel that did not believe that Yeshua was the Messiah and started to persecute them just as Paul had persecuted the believers. So between a lot of that, and then it kind of culminates in some of the writings that you see, like in AD 325, when Council of Nicaea came up with actually the question related to Pesach. The question of Pesach came in because you had, at that time, you had people that were having a debate as to commemorate the death and resurrection of the Messiah on the 14th day of the first month. Those are called another 50-cent word, the quartodecimans, or 14th, the 14ers. Or do you celebrate it related to a certain, I think it was probably a Sunday, certain first day of the week related to the equinox? And that was a big rift between huge parts of the believers of God at that particular point in time. And those that won out there, and that's written down, as we call it, the edicts of the Council of Nicaea there in 325, was that we don't want to have anything to do with these, using very, you could say, caustic language against the Jewish, what they were called, considered Jewish practices. So thus, Pesach and following the ways of God related to Pesach and God's calendar and such became connected to basically Judaism and rejection of Yeshua as the Messiah. So thus, those were connected together. And when you read either writings of the Middle Ages or even coming up into some more modern times, those two ideas were connected together, that all of these things you see in Leviticus 23 are Jewish. And so thus, you know, that is antithetical, that is antichrist, so that is not a part of the practice of believers. So then you started to see teachings that latched on to some things that Paul had written that were caustic on the ways that people were, you know, ramming, even as fellow believers. We read one passage in Titus today about those of the circumcision, how those people were ramming down their beliefs on how these things should be practiced. And Paul saying, no, you don't ram these teachings down upon people. And you see, like in Acts chapter 15, with the it's called the Jerusalem Council, where you have this decision. Well, what do you do with new believers from the nations? And it talks about the four things that they are to practice. And you know, there are those that say, well, that's what the commandments are for Gentiles. And then you say some people try to rope in the so-called Noahide laws, seven Noahide laws that are common in Judaism for believers, God-fearers from the nations, saying that those things are all that Gentiles are really, God wants them to do. So that is the whole long answer to that question of why is it that our fellow brothers and sisters and believers in Yeshua as the Messiah think that Leviticus 23 and these anniversaries of God are something that is obsolete, done away with, and such. It has a long history, and then folks have found proof texts in the Bible to back up their belief. Proof texts that, if you look at the totality of both Paul's writings, what Paul said, what Messiah said, and such, they don't say what people say they say. Goes back to that great passage from Princess Bride. Love it. It's like, I don't think that word means what you think it means. So it's like, it comes in with a lot of these proof texts that come up against these appointed times of God. It's like, I don't think that verse means what you think it means. So that's the long answer of that. And it's one of those things that this is a part of our whole heritage. So that's why when Yeshua was talking about that man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 8, when he's talking about that, that is how we know who God is. Because if you just start lopping off parts that, oh, God doesn't do that anymore, God doesn't like that anymore, God doesn't do this, God doesn't that, I'm thankful God doesn't like that anymore. Well, then who is your God? It becomes a God of your own creation, because you're now saying things that God said, didn't say, or perish the thought. He didn't mean to say that. He said it to them and thought then better of it later on in time. Yes.
But even though we don't have the Levitical priesthood, the way I see it is we still have our high priest, and so all that stuff's still going on in heaven, right?
Well, it's one of these things that these practices going forward, this pattern is in place. Remember we're talking about the Val V'Chomer, the light to the heavy? The Levitical priesthood is the light. The heavy is the Melchizedek, that is the high priest. That's what a lot of the letter to the Hebrews is about. It's showing us that, okay, you've seen this pattern here, the stuff that's talked about in the Torah. That's all good. That's all very good. Now we're going to ramp it up even more. We're going to turn up the brightness even more and show you more of what's going on. And then show you more of what's going on. More of what's going on. So that's, when you talk about Leviticus 23 and all these anniversaries that we have, they are really anniversaries of all these things that God has done, is doing, and will do.
Okay, but my question is, and there's a reason behind my question, is I understand the Melchizedek. I don't understand the whole thing. I'm still learning, but it doesn't take away from the Torah, right?
That's right. That's why it's talking about from light to heavy. It's not like this and then no, but this. It's like, well, if this is true, how much more is this? Because it's more significant. It's like you say, okay, you accept it and you understand this. This is how God starts things. Now, God is adding something on top of it, building on what has been done before.
So it's like that's the foundation.
That is the foundation.
Like the foundation, and he's building on it.
That's why when you look at the Haftarah portion, it's talking about the Levitical priesthood. It's building upon that.
Okay.
It's building upon what God has done. Because it's not like plan A, plan B God, where it's
right.
Like, oh man, that didn't work. Okay, now let's throw all that out. You know, chop the book off at Matthew and throw everything out before that. Then let's start something going on new here.
Okay.
Because otherwise, you are now talking about a different God. There's the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament. And sadly, there were people that actually taught that at different points in history. Right, it has to be built on something, because if the idea is that, okay, Levitical thrown out, Melchizedek comes in to replace it, then how can we trust what God revealed to us through the Levitical priesthood is even valid? Because if all that just gets erased, then how do you know what God is now saying is true? And when you start building on some sort of teaching that's Melchizedek, but it deletes the Levitical, how then are you sure of what you're coming out of, the teachings you're coming out of the Melchizedek are even true? What are they based on? If they're not based on the foundation of the Levitical, then what you talk about your great high priest, what are you basing that on?
Well, I was asking the same question. It's like, how can you say that there's a new thing when you can't put aside the Levitical? Because that's our whole foundation is
right.
This.
So I guess, like, in totally closing this, Leviticus, God didn't stop there. So that is one of the greatest things that we have today. It's not like God put this in place, you know, 3,000 years ago and then stopped, and that's the last we heard of anything. No, this was a part of a continual process that God is doing of really showing not only who he is, but kind of where the reset is coming to the whole world and how it operates. Yeah.
So is it not true that the Levitical priesthood, I mean, there's, because of the sin of the golden calf, that God had, they had to atone with the blood? I mean, I'm not sure if I said that right. Anyway, the Melchizedek priesthood was the original process that was given in the beginning of creation, right? The 7 days of creation. Each day there was a attributed, you know, like the menorah, that's what the menorah is for. Sorry. And that the Melchizedek was the original, God's original plan to begin with.
It is an original pattern.
Pattern.
Because,
however,
because one of the things that you'll see both mentioned in Psalms and in Hebrews, where it talks about this, is that, you know, he is after the order of, meaning just like follow the pattern that I showed you on the mountain. Melchizedek is a pattern that is used to show, okay, this is how God can operate parallel to, but maybe, you know, a little bit, you know, parallel to where God has been acting before. Because Melchizedek, as it's showed in Genesis, as it's revealed in the Psalms, and as it is shown again in Hebrews, it is something that happened parallel to Abraham. Because Melchizedek wasn't traveling with Abraham, you know. He was, it said mentioned that he was the king of Salem and such.
Right.
So, all right. So we're closing things up here. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for giving us your testimony through time, and we thank you for everything. And we ask you to build in us, the priesthood that you've been wanting to build. You've called us a kingdom of priests. And Father, we just ask that you continue to build in us what you've started, this great house, this great work. Father, we just ask that you guide us in showing the true picture of who you are into the world around us. That we represent you truthfully. Father, we just look forward to the time when you do make all things new. We thank you for these things in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's hallel.info. Hillel.info.